Hi there and welcome to Everyday Business with me, Aidan Donnelly. I've been analysing and investing in companies for nearly 30 years and I'm fascinated by how companies operate, the entrepreneurs who start them and the business people and managements that run them. In this podcast, I'll be talking to a whole host of people with different stories, backgrounds and journeys, learning about their businesses and gleaning some insights and lessons from their experience. For those that are listening, don't forget to like, share and subscribe if you enjoy what you hear. So without further ado to today's episode. Alan Andrews is widely regarded as a cafe and coffee expert and features prominently in both radio and print media. He created Coffee Culture in 2009, which specialised in coffee education and training. He travelled around the country helping aspiring and new cafe owners with their business development and growth. In 2015, Alan bought the old barracks in Bird Hill, Tipperary, which is a place for the coffee curious and proved a hit from the start as locals and tourists who came to enjoy the experience. The retail side of the business grew as they were able to provide delicious coffee for home as well as education to ensure customers were creating a similar level at home. In January 2022, Alan secured a warehouse on the Dock Road in Limerick City and opened its doors in July 2022. Alan intends to turn this into an open source coffee education building with total transparency for customers to see the coffee making process and learn all about coffee. An estimated $1.5 million will be spent to complete the project with the aim of launching the new offering in early 2026. In 2024, Alan launched Ireland's first ever destination coffee festival, the Bird Hill Coffee Festival, which will run again this June from the 27th to the 29th. Alan, you are very welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you so much. Delighted to be here. Tell my story.
Great. Brilliant. Right. I'm going to throw a bit of a controversial one in at the start, right? I won't go too much up with the stuff. So, do we really need another slant or enterprise revolving around coffee?
Well, that's actually a really good question. And I think the problem is the barriers to entry are so low that what you end up getting is a lot of bottom feeders and you don't actually get the quality delivered in the cup or through the customer experience. So we always need innovation in the industry, because if we don't innovate and if we don't drive the market forward, we don't actually give the customer an experience and we don't learn anything. And I think, and it's one of my pet hates right now at the moment, people think, and I don't know whether this comes from, you know, how we run our sites, but people think making coffee is easy and delivering a customer experience is easy. You can rent a coffee machine for $200 or $300 a month, right? And if you can do a deal on a lease and you can do a bit of carpentry, you could throw a counter together in a couple of days and you'd have a coffee shop, right? You don't have a brand, you don't have a destination, you don't have a product. But what we don't need in the market is really bad offerings and bringing down the customer experience and really people that just don't have an interest in the business. Because what happens is they come into the business, they're actually not truly passionate about coffee or providing customer experiences or providing
stack it
quality.
Right and sell it cheap.
Yeah, exactly, right? And so then what happens is they get into the market, they scrape a couple of hundred cups of coffee off me a day or off the other guy up the street that's really interested in it. They do that for about a year and a half until their January P30 and VAT return comes in. Then they realize there's actually no money in it because they've been charging too little because they're trying to compete on price against people like us who are delivering an experience. And then they go, I'm just not going to do this anymore. And they bottom out. And then somebody else goes in and does the exact same thing. So we really need to kind of get people thinking differently about how they create their coffee experiences, what it is that they're actually giving the customer. So I'm constantly getting messages from friends or people saying, you need to go visit this place, Jay's Cafe, whatever. Coffee's great. But great coffee should be standard now. It's about doing something else in the experience and having a much better product mix. So no, we don't need, more crap coffee shops. Yeah. We need really great coffee experiences for customers because that's what the customers want.
We were talking earlier, just before we started, about, and look, I'll hold my hand up and say I am not coffee an aficionado, but there is a huge amount of food science behind what coffee is, probably more than a lot of people realise and more than a lot of other industries that people think there's huge food science behind.
Yeah. And I found that out when we started doing education. As you said, we started off this coffee education business, Coffee Culture, back in 2009, and what we realized was, and I see it now, we in our business, we've a super team of people and we've a lot of processes that are very well managed on a day-to-day. And we make making great tasting coffee look easy. And I've no doubt about that. We make it look easy. And then when we bring people in behind the scenes, something like into the space in Bird Hill, and we show them the technical skill that's involved in it, that we're, for example, weighing the output of our espresso, that it's got to be 36 grams, or we're putting exactly 18.5 grams of coffee into the basket, first of all, or we're brewing at 92.5 degrees, or it's at 7 bar of pressure consistently throughout the shot to give you a flavour that comes out to your drink, and we can wash, rinse and repeat that every time. Okay, when we show people that technical part, they're mind blown. They go, God, I never realized it was this technical. And it's amazing to watch what's happening now in the market since COVID, that people are spending thousands of euros on home machines. Mm-hmm. Sage, De'Longhi, Lamazoco. Okay, so within that range, you're talking anything from €1,000 for a pretty good domestic machine up to 10,000, right, for the top end that we sell, Lamazocos. And the perception is that it's plug and play. Mm-hmm. You take this machine home, you throw some beans in the top and it'll make you great tasting coffee. And that's the myth, yeah. Right? And the companies are really good at selling that, yeah, aspirational end product. And then people come, literally they come to us on the dock road with their coffee machine in the back of the car, because we encourage, yeah, this, right? Yeah. And they say,
"Will it's you? Crap."
Yeah, exactly, right? And well, not and worse than that, our coffee's crap, right? Yeah. And I'm going, but there's no way our coffee's crap, because, yeah, we're all over it, right? Yeah. But they've been sold this myth that, mm, it's going to, all you do is press a button and it's going to taste great. Mm. Now, there are some innovations, and the machine makers are like the broader ones like Sage are really making great innovations to make it easier for the customer to understand how to brew coffee and how much coffee to put into the basket and how to tamp it and what buttons to press and how long it should run for and all these kind of things. That's really innovative, but they've been sold a myth, you know. Mm-hmm. So we know now that we see them coming back into us and they're trying to understand, and all of a sudden it's a bit like, I know people make this analogy with things like golf, right? Mm. You get into a sport and you start with one or two things and all of a sudden, yeah, just you're throwing money in at it and you're getting deeper and deeper and deeper into the science of it. Mm. So it is super technical. Mm. And that's only the brewing part at home. Yeah. We've all the other technical stuff that comes along the chain of supply. Mm. That's really interesting. And there's lots of nuances of how the coffee is processed, how the coffee is prepared, who the farmer is, what the farmer thinks, what are his biases in terms of generating a flavor profile for that particular bean, and can we harness it, and can we capture it, and can we put it in a bag, and can the customer then take that and put that into the cup? So yeah, it's amazing actually, yeah, in a sense, because we've actually got so much control over the flavor that we can develop or not develop, depending on what bias you want to, you know, move towards in terms of what's actually going to happen in the cup. So yeah, it's fascinating. It's actually fascinating, and it's amazing to watch how people learn how to develop those flavors. Are like when we onboard baristas, mm-hmm, like so when we bring baristas in to work for us that have maybe worked in another coffee shop, and no disrespect to them, but they think they've got some coffee experience, right? Yeah. They've exposure to making coffee on a day-to-day basis. But they've only ever worked with a one blend or a one, you know, bean origin, let's say maybe Brazil, in that coffee shop in a year. We're throwing beans at them from maybe 15 different countries of origin all around the world that have all possibly been processed, like treated at the farm in three or four different ways that they've never experienced, and they don't know how to brew those coffees. Yeah. So they're getting huge insights, they're getting huge learning on the job learning, and it's fascinating to watch, and it's really interesting to watch that person kind of mature into the coffee space, mm-hmm, and understand that Kenya coffee tastes this way or Costa Rica coffees taste this way. It's a fascinating to watch.
You mentioned there in terms of the you know, at the machine, you know, you're in the coffee shop and you've got the pressure the machine is on, the weight going in, the weight going out, and the hot water. Yeah. If I change any one of them, I've got a different taste coming out the other side, right? Yeah. But in the same way, then, like if I'm a coffee manufacturer, like once it leaves my farm, right? There's so many more things that can alter along the way. Like if I'm making Irish whiskey, it leaves my distillery. Nobody can really mess with it other than putting Coke into it, right?
And that's an appellation
that could never ever be done, right?
Yeah.
But it's very different with coffee.
100%, yeah. So that's you know, sometimes we've been to the coffee farms, and some of the farmers don't even realize how good their coffees are, because they, you know, I guess it's a bit like you come to farms in Ireland, and maybe farmers themselves don't know how to cook, like to create a Michelin star meal, right? Yeah. But yet when they go to the restaurant and they taste their carrots and their turnips and they've been treated this way, and it's, you know, it's chapter one, it's Michael Viljan, and you know, you're kind of going, God, that's, how did he create that, right? So we've been to farms and we've had coffee at the farms, and we've looked at the raw material being picked and how they treated it, and they're so meticulous about every step. But the farmer themselves know that they've got a really good product, right? But they don't actually know how to develop it in the cup. Mm. And that's where it comes to our expertise in terms of taking that product, roasting it in the first step to capture the flavor. And I always say to guys, like, that's the job of the roaster, is to capture the flavor, and then to create a window within which the baristas can brew into a window of flavor. So depending then on all the other parameters, right? Because it's super technical and probably boring for most people, right? But depending on how well you extract that, how well you pull those flavors out, you might get, like if we talk about Brazil for a second, or Central South American coffees, you might get dark stone fruits, so dates, dates and stone fruits, and then you might get nuts, which could be pecans or toasted nuts. But if you extract that coffee a little bit longer, you might get hazelnuts, and you might get bitter chocolate. So there's a window within which, and that's why I think we're so successful in terms of educating the customer, because we can always develop a flavor window for customers, and most of the time, because we actually can't taste every cup, because that's the uniqueness of each cup, we believe that the coffee's going to fall within a flavor window, and they're going to have a good experience with that beverage. Mm. And within a range of flavors that we've identified through a tasting, we know that that's what they're going to hit. So it's very exact in terms of the science part of it, and it's super technical. And I think that's where customers is moving now. They're beyond the point of that tastes good. They're now kind of getting into it on a technical side and at home, like we said, and they're trying to uncover flavors and play with flavors. And lots of home baristas now, like people at home, can brew coffee better than most coffee shops.
Right.
Yeah. And that's a good place to be.
Yeah. And taking that on then, you know, are we coming to the point where, you know, there's people out there that will go and say, actually, you know what, I know what a cup of coffee tastes like, and I'm willing to pay €12 for my cup, because I'm only going to, in the same way that, you know, if I'm drinking white wine, I know I can drink a €6 glass of wine, and I know I can drink a €20 glass of wine. Yeah. Is the same culture developing within coffee?
Yeah, there's definitely a recognition of what quality is now. We can definitely see that. Mm. And we see that across all of our sites, but mostly we see that in Bird Hill, because we have a range of coffees that we sell in Bird Hill. And they are from €5 or €6 a cup for Brazil up to eight, I think 15 at the moment. So we have a competition coffee on the bar from Daniel Horbat, and we have another one on from Wojciech Tisler. And these are both Irish barista champions. So one is a World Brewers Cup champion, and Wojciech is a barista champion in Ireland. And they've got competition coffees that they have roasted, mm-hmm. that we want to experience, and we want to let our customers experience. And then we have a range of coffees, Costa Rica, Honduras, Kenya, in the middle. So between 6 and 14 per cup that customers can taste. And we see customers that when we opened, we've a roastery in Bird Hill in Tipperary. And you mentioned at the top of the story, we've a new site that we're developing. And the new site that we're developing, we've put very little money into it in the scale of things. But what we did put there was a coffee machine, obviously, and one grinder, right? Right. We only put one coffee on offering because we wanted the service to be fast and efficient. And when we opened that site, our customers came from Bird Hill Tipperary into that site, and they were giving out that there was no choice.
Right.
And they were willing to pay for the choice. They're willing to pay €7 for Costa Rica or €8 for Ethiopia because that's the flavour profile that they liked.
Like.
That they liked, yeah. Mm-hmm. They loved the delicacy of that or the acidity or the blueberry flavours or the orange notes of Costa Rica, and that's what they liked. And it's fascinating to watch that.
What made coffee culture different when you set it up in 2009?
I think it was our bias towards education. So I set up an education company in 2009. There was not an active education company in Ireland for teaching people how to make great coffee. There were loads of coffee roasters that had, you know, like Dave McKiernan started all that back in 2005, you know, when he came out of Bewley's and he spearheaded Java. And I actually just don't think he gets the respect for doing, you know, but for kind of breaking the system in a way, you know, he really went hard at it.
Yeah.
And he carved the path for all the other roasters to join in, you know. If only we could all get a sellout deal as well as he did. But so I think there was a gap in the market in that time. There were lots of coffee roasters and there were lots of people coming into the market of opening coffee shops because it was post-COVID. People might have got deals or packages to get out of the jobs at the time. The barriers to entry are very low in coffee. Yeah.
So get a horse box and stick it inside
like,
the road.
This was it, right? Yeah, and you had every, you know, GAA player, like at every GAA club was like backing a horse box and just throwing out, you know, pretty poor quality coffee.
Yeah.
And then in, you know, after COVID, but in 2000, same thing happened after COVID. So in 2009, post-recession, you had a lot of that going on, real low barriers to entry and people delivering pretty awful, pathetic cups of coffee and the customer not knowing any better. Mm. So I looked at that landscape, that market landscape, and I said, well, there's lots of roasters, there's lots of end users and we need to bridge that education gap. There was a gap in learning, and how can we do that? We were very much B2B, so we never really dealt with consumers. You know, we were behind the scenes. We were working with companies like the Bagel Bars and KSG Kylemore Service Group that had, you know, over 100 sites across the country. We worked with a lot of baristas then who are now business development managers for roasters. So they came along on their journey. They were doing their barista level one, barista level two. So what was different about that was that we were bridging that gap in education, and we were helping every coffee shop in the country deliver better tasting coffee.
So then is it more about the cafes or more about the coffee?
For me now,
yeah.
In terms of our product offering or what I like?
Well, in terms of your drive now.
Oh, for me, it's all about the cafes.
Yeah, is it?
Yeah, it's about the hustle.
Right.
Yeah. Like, because I love the game of being in business.
Yeah.
I love finding an opportunity that somebody else hasn't spotted and building a product around that and hustling and scaling. And I love the challenge of getting a site and knowing that I can get it to, you know, a 10K a week, a 15K a week, a 20K a week, whatever that number is, and hacking it so that it does that. Mm. And that's the fun part I get out of it. I see people like Thomas, let's say our head roaster, and he runs the site in Bird Hill. Excuse me. I see how he is super enthusiastic about buying the coffees from the different farms and getting all the flavours in. And I love the fact that he's deep into that.
Mm-hmm.
And I've done that, but I get the real thrill is being out on the beat and hustling and doing a deal.
Yeah.
And that's what I love about it. Yeah.
And so therefore it was always your intention to start a business, was it? And coffee just happened to be the nexus of it.
I'm reminded every time I come to Dublin. I'm from Dublin originally, but every time I come up, I remember my first business was this cocktail making glasses, and it was called Swizzle Sticks, right? So these are the little sticks that you put into your glass. I was running alcohol education, where people could sign up for an 8-week class and learn. In each week, they could learn a different spirit. It was gin, vodka, rum, tequila, as the weeks went on. And I don't know why I'm interested in that. I think it goes back to maybe on my mom's side. My granny ran a vegetable, you know, grocery store back then. And my mom always wanted, I think, to have a B&B. She was very hot, you know, big into hospitality and that kind of thing. So I think that's somewhere there's a drop of blood in me that has that in me. Yeah. And I've kind of I've never kind of shirked from it. I've always kind of gone that way. I've always been very, I'll say confident now, but it definitely came across as arrogance, you know, 20 years ago, wanting to do my own thing and being stubborn on things the way I wanted to do things and being specific about things. And I'd say to people, I'm not difficult. I'm just specific. You know, I want things done a certain way and I want standards to be set at a certain level. And that's the way we're going to achieve things. And I'm detailed about stuff. So yeah.
You obsess about the small things.
Yeah, I do obsess about small things, and I think that's a good and a bad thing in the sense that, and here's where it hurts in a way. I visit all the shops every day, but I only pick up on the small things, which really, can I say?
Yes.
Sorry. Yeah. Really pisses staff off because in general, I just let them off and do whatever you want and run the business the way you're given complete autonomy to do like whatever they want, whether it's Carolina and Gucci or Meshi and Cork. They're the managers, or, you know, Louise and wholesale. It's like, that's your area. Mm. You manage that. But if I see a label on a bag wrong, you know, I'm going to get annoyed at that. And or if I see, you know, a customer hasn't been greeted by the time they get to the edge of the coffee counter, I'm going to get annoyed at that. And sometimes that comes off as being, you know, I'm sure for the staff on the receiving end that that's very annoying. Mm. But what I try to remind them is like, you're doing everything else amazingly well. But it's if you don't catch those little small things
that make the experience.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. But also you get complacent and you go, ah, sure. They're grand. Like I'll say hi to them in a second. Yeah, and it's like, no. And it's, you know, those small things of opening the conversation with hello and closing it. Like people love to say goodbye. Mm. They're like, you know, you could say, have a great day now when you serve them their coffee and they're going, thanks very much. And they stand there and they stir their coffee with put a sugar in or whatever. And then they're walking out and they're still saying, thanks, you know, and you're like, yeah, bye. Yeah. You know, they still want that closure. So all of those small little things are, I think they're super important and we can't ignore them, you know. So, yeah, I don't sweat over them, but I do bring them up and I'm sure it's really annoying for the team because we do our weekly meetings and I'd be going, I'm not happy with this. I'm not happy with this. But I am 98% happy but it's just we need to keep focused on these small things because that is what makes the difference. That's what separates good from amazing, you know.
And when you set up the business, like this idea out there as an entrepreneur, you have to wear an awful lot of hats, right, when you set up the business. Yeah. And nobody's good at all those hats. And therefore, you know, some people make the mistake of trying to do it all themselves. Others are sensible enough and get in a couple of co-founders or outsource the stuff that they're not good at. Yeah. What did you do in terms of setting the business up?
So at the very start, when we did Coffee Culture, I only focused on financials in terms of outsourcing that part. I wanted to make sure that part was managed. The rest at the time I could handle myself.
Yeah.
It was 1-4 in terms of like a training ratio of people, right? So I could do that. I built the website, you know, back then. So I just built a page and tried to optimize it. And I did a bit of that stuff. And then I started to use, as I got busier, right? So I couldn't obviously do all that stuff. I started to bring in specialists, but really simply through like a site like Upwork.
Right.
And I actually still work with a lot of these people today. So maybe like a branding design, like a girl, Tatiana, still work with her today. She did our Coffee Culture logo 15 years ago. Andrew, who does some website coding for us, used him back then to update the site. So we just outsourced that on real kind of like Fiverr.com stuff, you know, really, really cheap, could manage it, didn't have a lot of money, had no money really. Like our first 3 years turnover, like obviously it's just turnover, but like 27 grand, 52 grand, 76 grand years 1, 2, and 3, like no money in it for me. Mm-hmm. So I had no choice but to do everything, like you say, and then scrape a bit of, you know, help from other people. And then we got to a stage where I had to bring in another trainer to help me do 2 or 3 days a week or other people. And now, sure, look, that's completely flipped. Like we've nearly 50 staff now and I still bring in consultants for loads of different things.
Right.
So I feel obviously my worldview on the business is myopic. You know, I've got a tunnel vision on things and, you know, I loved getting that outside bit of expertise or someone who sees things just a bit different to me. And I'm willing to pay for that and bring people in.
That's a sensible thing to do. You've a pretty eclectic academic record. Starts with a diploma in hotel management, then a degree in business studies and marketing, then a certificate in architecture and business construction, or building construction, and then a master's in neuromarketing. Right?
Yeah.
How did that all come about and where's it all going to?
Well, you missed the most important one, which was my certificate in hotel and catering supervision, right? Which was because, and I ended up doing a certificate for 2 years because my leaving cert was so bad, right?
Okay.
I was more interested in playing sport every day of the week.
Right. Okay.
And I, much of my father's disappointment, I scraped into college and I managed to get a supervision course. But that all makes sense in my head, right? That progression. I always wanted to be a hotel manager. That's okay. What I want, right? I wanted to be a chef. And then my dad said, you're not becoming a chef, right?
Chef's no
work,
money in that.
There's no money in that, right?
You work all hours.
You work all hours. You'll never see your family. And he was like, look, he was dead right, you know? And I thank him for that. I hate him for lots of other things. But I thank him for that. No, I don't hate him, Scott. I shouldn't say that. But my dad at the time was like, look, you know, I don't think you want to be a chef. I think you should be a manager, right? Which was great. Like, step up a bit there now. You're going to be a manager. And I did the hotel management stuff. I finished hotel management in Carlbrew Street and I was 20 years old. Right, so 17, 18, 19, I took a year out. And then I did when I was 20. And I finished hotel management at 20 going, there's no way I can be a hotel manager. Like, this is ridiculous.
I wouldn't let me manage myself, never mind.
Yeah, exactly, right? Like, that's just ridiculous. So I had a real interest in marketing, I just loved the whole idea of consumer behaviour, the psychology of it, and being able to, you know, the hustle, being able to sell something. Really enjoyed that. So I went and I progressed into DCU and I did 2 more years in DCU, business studies and marketing. I felt that was going to be my angle. And when I came out of that, I guess at the time I didn't want to do more education because I was kind of more or less 6 years. I was 2 years in, took a year out, 3 more years. So that was a 6 year. And I felt I was old enough to go into the world and work a bit. So I wanted to do that. And I had a taste of it for a year because I left Carlbrew Street after 2 years and I took a year out and I made a load of money as a 19-year-old waiter down in RDS.
Yeah.
Working with Fitzers back then. And I was making stupid money. Like really, like €1,000 a week as a 19-year-old. It was ridiculous working as a waiter. But I then went to work for a while and I got involved in a hotel project. And I got involved in opening our own cafes in Limerick. And I was fixated about the layouts. I really, what was bugging the hell out of me was an architect would design a space, you know, to win an award, but not so
to
that
be
was
functional.
Not to be functional, right? And this was really annoying me in terms of how we built cafes. And we built 4 cafes. I built 4 cafes with Delish back then. And I set them out in such a way that they were completely functional and that they made sense to the customer, they made sense to the staff and you could be as efficient as possible and give great customer service, you know. So not all the stuff was at the back and not all the stuff was at the front and things mattered where they were located. So that may, in terms of that, that's how I ended up getting into construction studies and architectural design. So I there was a functionality need. So in terms of the you know the progression, I was interested in selling stuff to customers. I was interested in hospitality. I was interested in making sure the building was built
correctly,
fit for purpose.
Optimized
exactly. Yeah. And so that all made sense to me. And then now, when I see what we have in terms of creating a customer experience, I am currently fixated with stimuli and how the customer reacts to an environment and how they experience an environment. And I don't actually think enough people give enough consideration. And this is what I mean about the bottom feeders in the market. They're just simply throwing a coffee machine up on a counter and producing pretty poor quality coffee. And they think that that's an offering and it's just not good enough. Mm. Like the market has moved on. Customers have moved on. They've been all over the world, right? They've been to Australia. They've been to New Zealand. They've had coffee experiences. So now I'm fixated with creating like curated spaces that people go in and they have almost like a subliminal, amazing experience and they don't quite know why.
Right.
They don't quite know why they've enjoyed this better than somewhere else. And it's because we put so much work into workflows. I've put so much work into the aesthetic. We put so much work into the product, like what goes in the cup. But that's almost you know, third or fourth, like that's a given. Like in my world, us making great coffee is a given, right? Yeah. So all the other things are super important. The color of the branding, the aesthetic, the way the customer service is given, what's actually said to you. You know, like, you know, if Michelle comes in, it's like, hi, Michelle, you know, are you on our loyalty scheme? That's great, Michelle. Your coffee ready at the end of the bar, Michelle, and Sarah's going to make it for you, right? So now there's lots of names. And when Sarah serves your coffee, it's like, oh, Michelle, yeah, that's your flat white. Have a great day. So there's lots of engagement. So I'm really focused on building out all the subliminal parts of the experience that create an experience so that the customer, you know, is kind of mind blown, but they don't know why. They don't know why this is like unreal. Like when people go to Bird Hill Coffee Roastery sits on with a backdrop of the lower lake of the Shannon, the Pollock Trails, which is a walkway down to the river. So Pollocks is where you've got like a raised bank, and if the water overfills the bank, it drops into these pollocks, right? So you can walk down there and you can see it from where the old barracks is. We've got this coffee roastery that's built in a conservatory. So you can sit in a glass house, basically. You can watch the coffee being roasted and 8 different varieties of coffees that you'd like to taste. And you can sit looking at the hills. The farm is running down to the lake, and then the backdrop of the hills, Moylossa behind that, that you could walk up the Clare Hills. And to sit there and just take in the space and have a coffee, like, and be mindful, like, is like people just, they get it, but you don't get it unless you visit it. You know, it's a real experience.
And do you think the experience alters how we perceive the flavour of the coffee?
100%. Yeah, so does the cup colour. Imagine that. Yeah. Like, yeah, like all of these things. Because now, you know, when you come in for a coffee in Bird Hill, people just go, yeah, I just get a cappuccino. And the staff go, yeah, what origin would you like? And people, oh, sure, I don't know what origin I want. Like, just give me something strong. And then the guys go, no, but you have to pick an origin because, well, A, there's a price difference.
Yeah.
And B, there's a flavour difference. Yeah. And they, you know, I joke because I pretend like they've got a bucket of full stops and commas. Like they're literally putting them down in front of the customer going, no, this is different.
Yeah.
Right. And talk about detail. Like over the years, I've added another step to that customer experience to really annoy the staff. Right. So, if we don't take all these, like if we don't stop you and ask you to choose an origin, you're not going to perceive the thing as different.
Yeah.
You're just going to go, no, I want a cappuccino. Yeah. There's a fiver. Like I'm having a meeting here with Alan, you know?
Yeah.
So, but if the guys really take the time, and it's so funny to watch at the weekends because you get tourists arriving and they'll grab a table for 4 and then one of them will go up to the counter to order the coffee. And then he's got to go back down to the table and pull them all up, you know? Yeah. And they all have to come up and they have to smell the coffee. And that is building the experience. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden they're taken in the space and you've slowed them down and then they're mindful about it. And now they're thinking about it. It's a bit like going to the races and there's 6 horses and you haven't a clue which one's going to win.
You throw a dart
and now you're all in, right? Yeah. Now you're all in a number 4 and you're going, come on, you know? And like you want it to be amazing because you've had to consider it. And that's what I think is, you know, super important about what we do and how you build out an experience. So yeah, it all matters. Mm-hmm. You know, and like compare that to Gucci, which is in the city centre in Limerick City. And the only comma or full stop we're putting on the customer journey is, would you like rich, medium or light? Now it's a step up. It's still a question, but we're not getting into 8 different varieties and we're not getting you to smell the coffee and we're not talking to you about the flavour profile and whether it's a natural process or whether it's honeyed or how you can expect the flavours to change if you add milk to it. Yeah. So we're not getting into that, but
It's no different to me going and getting a hamburger at McDonald's or me going to Chapter 1 and if I know the difference.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And that's where the education comes into it. So if we, I just feel that my duty is to unpack that and to give it back to the customer in a way that they can digest it and make them more knowledgeable, because when I make them more knowledgeable and I make them to consider the coffee, I know I've won that customer and they'll come to our sites for our coffee and they're not going to go to the cheaper. And actually, now it's not about price. Now it's about flavour. And that's what we're trying to get. Like, it's not about price. You know, it's about flavour. It's about experiences and it's about, you know, learning. And actually, like most people will have 1 or 2 cups of coffee a day, right? Good cups of coffee. and they're willing to pay for that. Mm. And that's what we see. I could give you the numbers on it. Mm. I know what people are willing to spend on a cup of coffee, and it's far more than most people think.
Yeah. Customers are great at telling you what's wrong with a product, but not necessarily telling you how to solve that or what the solution is. So what's your approach to that?
Well, I'm pretty good at firing back at customers in the reviews, and I probably need to tone that down a bit. So I've had my... because I get emotional about it, right? Like, and I kind of feel we put so much effort into delivering a thing, and then someone goes and writes you a one-star review and says it's shit. And you're going... But it's like, it's never that.
Yeah.
It's never that, yeah. Right? It's like, we're not going to get it right.
Yeah.
We do nearly 10,000 cups of coffee a week, right? So even at 99%, there's 100 cups, right, that we've messed up, right? Yeah. If my maths is right, on the fly. So we're never going to get it right all the time, but we're never intentionally trying to do it wrong, okay? We're always trying to make it better because we want to win customers, not lose customers. And, So to answer your question, customer gives you feedback. You've got to decide, is this valid feedback or not valid feedback? Mm. Is this going to damage my reputation or not damage my reputation? Some people seem to be targeted, and I think sometimes it's personal. They want to see your business fail because they just don't like it, because maybe you took on their niece and it didn't work out and you sacked the niece.
Or maybe their niece is the one that has the horse box down the road.
There you go. Right, yeah, absolutely, right? There's competition, right?
Yeah.
So sometimes you're kind of going... Have they got context, right? And sometimes you have to look and say, like, we've had a complaint at the very start, people going, can't believe I paid £6 for a cup of coffee. Like, that's ridiculous. Mm. And what the problem is, we've put them in a situation where they weren't aware of the price, right? We didn't communicate that clearly before they were asked to pay. And now all of a sudden they've had to pay and they're embarrassed. They don't want to pay it. And they're going, that's a ridiculous price. And they're struck by the price. But they're left defenseless, right? Yeah. They didn't get a chance to see the price before they came in or whatever, and they've been blindsided, right? Now, that's not the intention, but that's the way it happened. Because we didn't present the menu properly or whatever, right? So we've got to manage that situation. And sometimes you've got to dig into the review or dig into the feedback and go, what has actually happened here?
Yeah.
What actually happened here? Did we mess this up? Like, I actually only had it last week. Guy gave me a review, he sent us a picture of an acai bowl that we serve in Guji, right? And he was like, I got way too much peanut butter. Like, it was half peanut butter, half acai. And he was like, I'll send you a picture. And it looked ridiculous, right? And he was right. And it was like, why did it happen that way? So he was right. I was pretty sure we had a standard around how much peanut butter to put in. And he ordered a dish which was called a Nutalicious. And it has peanut butter in it, and he asked for extra peanut butter.
Yeah.
But he got something like 70 grams of peanut butter, like a ridiculous amount. So you have to kind of step back a bit. Sometimes I think they are targeted, and sometimes people just, you know, they're not our customer. Mm. That's...
Yeah, like the coffee they ordered was the wrong coffee for them in terms of their taste.
Maybe. But also, you know, not everybody has an appreciation for coffee. And that's why we're trying to bring them on a journey, right? And people are quite happy going to McDonald's or going to Apple Green and having a pretty substandard coffee, in my view, to what we can deliver. And then they don't understand where our pitch is at. And that's just fine. Not everybody's your customer. And we accept that.
What's the hardest part of being the CEO of the company?
What is the hardest part about being a CEO? I actually couldn't, because I love it. Like, I actually think it's so easy.
Right.
Yeah. Like, I don't mean that being facetious, but I love the journey.
Mm.
I love, I think I could answer that on behalf of other people because I see how other people struggle with it. I have a really great work-life balance. We work hard from early morning and then by 4 o'clock, all our work is done. Right. And I don't get a phone call any day of the week after 4 o'clock, maybe 5 o'clock.
Mm.
I don't get a phone call. It'd be unusual for me to get a phone call in the evening.
Right.
It'd be unusual for me to get a WhatsApp or a text from anybody in the team. We're in a space now where I guess if for the last six years, I've known that I wanted to scale and I've known where I wanted to go with the business and how I want to take it forward. So I've been very strategic in terms of how I set up the business, the pillars in terms of the workforce that we put in and how we do that and how we scale and how we manage the money that we make and how we reinvest it back into the company. What's the hardest part for me? gosh, I probably the hardest part for me is actually to stay focused on what it is that we want to go after, because I can get distracted. But
that's a question. It's interesting. Right. You know, there is this idea that with success comes the risk of distraction.
Mm. Right. Yeah.
So how do you keep yourself focused on the core dream, if you will?
Yeah. So that's great, because I think, so what can happen is customers tell you should do this.
Yes, yes.
Staff say you should do this. And you've got to be militant about what it is that you offer. And I tell you what keeps you on track, looking at numbers.
Yeah.
You look at revenue, you look at targets, you look at your product mix, and we track everything every week, as we should be doing, you know. And if you know, that's what will keep you focused in terms of where's the money come from? Where's the margin? Are we making money on this site? Are we not? How far behind is this site? Like Cork, our new site in Cork is 8%, you know, running at an 8% loss now every week, and we're trying to drive that up, you know. So yeah, you could add products into the mix, and sometimes you need to do that, because you know, maybe the market isn't ready for what you want to do, right? So you have to maybe add a product into the mix and
take it step by step,
and then maybe strip it back again, you know, when you feel you've done enough of that. And like we did that in Bird Hill at the very start in the roastery, but I learned. So actually a great example is Bird Hill. The roastery has a huge site, so you could fit 100 people sitting outside looking at the hills. And I bought a couple of containers, like 20-foot containers, and we built a kitchen, and the intention was to make cakes out of it. And then I said, oh, you know, it'd be great here, because I love food, right? Let's do a food truck, because this was on trend. This was 2019. Yeah. So we did a food truck, and we did vegan bowls, right? So you could have your all your vegetables, pulses, grains, all cooked in you know, vegans, let's say no chicken stocks or beef stocks or anything like that. So everything's vegan, and then you could add your protein from the side. So it could be halloumi cheese or lamb koftas or chicken skewers. Fantastic, right? And it got to a point where we were doing like 150 meals a day out of this food truck, and it was unreal. The vibes were amazing, right? And then in the other truck, we stripped it out and we put a band. Right. So Saturdays and Sundays in the afternoons, 2019, for June, July and August, we were serving bowls where you can add your protein. You could go inside then and have your coffee. The music was playing and the vibes were unreal.
Yeah.
Like, and I just felt this is completely wrong. Right. This is miles away from what we're trying to be, which is a coffee roastery and being a destination for people who are coffee curious, because that was our tagline, a destination. Now, yeah, all these people are coffee curious, but now we're turning this into a food fest.
Yeah.
Right. And actually, it wasn't true to what we wanted to actually create. So that was just an example of how we went off. You know, we just, yeah, we were on the road, but now we're turning this into kind of like something that I didn't want it to be.
That's a hard decision, though, when it's something successful and you're going back to the looking at the numbers, you're kind of going, this is making money, but are we true to our core or not?
Yeah, yeah. And that was a big lesson for me, because I love the food thing, but we're not in the food business, right? We're not in table service. I've crystallized this now, and I know that, right? We're not in table service. We're not in the food business. Our business is selling coffee beans to people, whether that's through wholesale, you know, and we'd have 40 or 50 wholesale accounts. Like, we're small in the wholesale world right now, but we're big in the retail domestic world, right? I would like to think we're one of the front, you know, first to mind places that people will go if they want to buy coffee for home, and if they want to be educated on how to make great coffee at home. And that's where our gravy is, right? So, you know, we were just talking about numbers in terms of like the product mix. Our retail mix, like 25% of what we sell every week. So from every 10,000 euros, 2,500 of that is beans of coffee. You know, coffee beans in bags. Right. That's what it is. And I'm focused on that, because actually that experience is maybe, you know, it's a 5 or 7 minute, maybe 10 minutes at the top end of engagement for a first customer that comes in to want to buy beans. But after that, that experience is less than 30 seconds. They come in, they order flat white, they're going to buy a bag of Brazil. That's 55 quid, 5 euro for their coffee, that's 60 quid. There's not a restaurant in the city that can sell 60 quid that fast.
Yeah.
And that's where our leverage is. Yeah. And I know, and I see that. And that's zero labor cost. Mm. And that's also the other thing. So we're drilling down at the numbers I'm looking at. And I tell you one thing, that will focus you. Yeah.
And it's even easier if they're buying it online. Can they buy it online?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
So like zero interaction.
Yeah, yeah, but actually we get more engagement in shop, right? Because we do want them to engage in store, right? So of course you can buy online, and we get people have their you know 12-month subscriptions and that, and a lot of people, because they've come to like the things like the coffee festival, they're there, they're involved. They're not actually in our area, but we see our like we're flipped on that. So our in-store buying is much more active than our online stuff.
Okay.
Because we've got four shops,
yeah,
and because the in-store experience of buying is education based, and almost for that price per bag, they want a bit of knowledge,
yeah,
on this day, and they want to know, and how does this, you know, react? How, should I change my settings, yeah, for this coffee?
Yeah.
They want and that brings it back to the in-store experience. And that's where I see the value going forward is that. And that's why we're building out that roastery and the open source coffee, the, you know, I'm calling it like a Willy Wonka coffee experience. Like, that's what I want to do. And I said, like, I you know, Dave McKiernan did it back in 2005, is like making things more transparent for the wholesale customer. But we're doing it for the retail customer. We're really going, we're leveraging in on that. Yeah. Yeah.
When it comes to staff, are you a hire talent or develop from within?
A mix of both. So, so we're caught right now in terms of the type of talent we want, because we need a C-suite, you know, because we're at that scale. We have some amazing development from within the team. And like Meshi, our manager down in Cork, came to us. She was a head barista, maybe supervisor in a site. She's with us now 5 years, and she's developed to a site manager. And she's been running, she was running two sites up until January. We closed one in January, which is a good decision, closing a site. So Meshi has been a great development. A student, you know, she's developed really well. We've got Thomas, who's our manager in Birdhill. Tom came in as a barista. He was working for markets. So he's driving to a market for an operator, and he'd bring all the stuff and he'd unload it and he'd set up the whole thing, sell coffees all day, unpack it back and bring it back. And he was doing this 2 or 3 days a week. And I just felt that was the kind of an energy that we needed to bring into the company. And, you know, Tom is now he runs Bird Hill, and he's a very core himself and Meshi, like they would be big cogs in our overall machine. And I love the fact that they're there long enough that they're not afraid to push back and to question my decisions. But I don't actually get enough of that.
Yeah.
I don't get enough kickback, and I don't like the fact that people think I always have the answer, because as the CEO, you're like, just call Alan,
yeah,
and you know, he'll have the answer. And there's all, like loads of examples. Like we've Luis now in the Dock Road. We've Jennifer in the Dock Road. Jennifer came in, no English, Brazilian, into our kitchen. And now she's, you know, second chef in the kitchen. We've got Luis, who came in. He was a carpenter, never worked in coffee. And when we were building out the Dock Road, I was like, you're a carpenter. You can help me with this, right? Tell you what you do. You come in and help me build this out. And we were really paneling walls and just tidying the place up. And I'll teach you how to make coffee. And now he's head of logistics in the Dock Road. And when we open the roastery there, he'll be a huge cog in that. So there's lots of development in the team as we build. And even I alluded to it earlier on, when we take on baristas from other coffee shops that have, you know, limited knowledge and exposure to coffees, and they come into our site. Like we know, like I know it takes someone 12 to 16 weeks to bed into working as a barista in Birdhill, because it's very intimidating. You've 8 or 9 coffees right now, and they will change in 3 months time because the seasons change and the origins change, and you go again. But where we are looking, I suppose, to recruit over the next year to 2 years will be in those much bigger roles. Right. I really feel we've just taken on business development. I really feel we could do with someone that's going to be very aggressive and will challenge me and almost like look to replace myself, because I don't want to get in the way of the growth of the business.
Yeah.
And I need to figure out how I'm going to
balance the two.
Yeah, but just fit in going forward, because I find I'm great at the hustle and doing the deal and finding the site and moving on. I have a huge bias towards marketing, which, you know, I find that easy. But those very senior roles, so sit
that backfill you as the you know, frontier man almost.
Yeah, but also, you know, operations wise and strategic wise, like I'm big into strategy. I feel that's one of my big strengths. But I'm not I'm probably not very good at week-to-week communication. I kind of get bored with that kind of, like, you're having a meeting, like, oh, call me if you need me kind of thing. You guys run it because they're all site managers. Yeah. So what do you need me for? You know, I'm trying to make myself redundant out of certain roles. So I'm this year, we have a lot going on with sites opening, and I do need to plug in. Now I have taken advice from a couple of mentors, and there's a couple of people that I know are on the hook that I'm going to be able to leverage off when the time is right, like coming towards September, October this year. I need to make a plan for that. But right now, there are gaps that we need to fill at that, like at a very senior level, you know, at a very senior level to kind of question me, you know, and challenge me, yeah.
How do you deal with setbacks?
We just move on. Like, I think shit happens all the time and you've got to believe in yourself. I think we haven't had many, really. We've had some challenges from... we've had some challenges, I think, in terms of making decisions on whether we should keep businesses open or not, you know, but I think that's just all part of it. Yeah, it's part of it. Like, you got to break eggs and make omelets and all that kind of stuff. We haven't actually had many. I was thinking about this on the way up, so it's 3 hours in traffic, right, to think about. And I was thinking about this, like, We run a really good business, you know, a really good business. We've never had to get outside investment. We've been pretty strident in terms of managing our pricing and putting our prices up because that's just the market. And every time I've done it, the staff have questioned the decision, but it's the right decision to make. We're here to grow a business. We're here to keep them all employed. Yeah. We're here to scale. We're here to put money back into the business.
You're not a charity.
We're not a charity. Like, you know, and we're not here to make millions yet, right? Mm. I mean, we might get our buyout, like, but I love the hustle of it and driving forward, and I love the game of making a business profitable. And it all feeds back into this one funnel where we're going to go again and go again. So we run a really good business. We're very well organized, and we haven't dealt in touch. Like, I'm sure something else will come along, but we haven't dealt with many setbacks. And I guess, look, I started this from nothing, right? I started this from nothing, you know, 2009. I had the laptop that I took from my redundancy and the mobile phone that I didn't have to pay for.
Yeah.
And I borrowed my mom's 1992 red Starlet, you know, because I'd lost my company car.
Yeah.
So, like, I have nothing to lose. You know, I don't care where it, like, I don't really care where it goes in the greater sense of things. So when I go back to that, like, I felt actually... I never felt pressure in the business until I took the deal on the dock road, right? And actually, even doing the deal on the dock road, I never felt any pressure or that I was overreaching, right? You know, and if your dreams aren't big enough, what's this thing? If the dreams aren't, if you're not worried, if you're not scared by your dreams, you're not dreaming big enough, right?
Yeah.
So we did the deal on the dock road, and it's more or less like it's 100 grand a year rent, and it's a 9,000 square foot building. And at the time, I think we had about 24 staff maybe on the team. And the irony in the whole thing was when I started in 2009, I had just myself to worry about. All I needed was 3 grand a month to cover my mortgage and to pay for my kids' childcare and to keep myself afloat, right? You know, like, that was the absolute minimum that I needed. And I didn't have that for a couple of years. And I was taking 188 off the dole, and I was doing a couple of Nixers and trying to make a bit of cash and trying to keep it all going. When I eventually signed the deal for the Dock Road, and I was taking on this 15-year lease at 100 grand a year, the realization kicked in. Oh, and I was like, what have I done, right? Well, it's not like, what if this goes tits up and I've 20-something people now that are depending on me...
For their mortgage.
For their, 100%, right? And their partners or their kids, right? So, like, is it 2 or 3 times X that... And what, you know, could I lose it all now, right? And we had a bit of money in the bank, and we were just out of COVID, right? So we had made lots of money through COVID. And actually, it's amazing how the timing works. So we had made great money in COVID. We went and looked at this site. We were dealing with very capable, big landlords in Limerick, McMahon's. And they were super organized, really black and white, like operators, you know. And they were like, yeah, we want to see your financials. And I was like, oh, here you go. Like, we've just come out of COVID. We've loads of money in the bank. And they wanted to see if we were bankable, like if we could take this on, if we could run it. And I just remember feeling, God, like, what have I done here? Like, as soon as I got the keys, I was like, and actually, yeah,
absolutely. Right.
And it was so funny. So the difference, so when I took on Bird Hill, it wasn't such a big deal, right? Yeah. We leased it, right? We didn't buy it. It was 25 grand a year or something like that at the time. And we just did a handshake with the landlord. Like, I didn't even have a lease. Mm-hmm. I went in and Noel, a lovely man, Noel O'Toole, went in, told him what I want to do. And he was like, well, how much do you want to pay? And I think he might have said a grand a month or something. And I was like, oh no, I wasn't thinking that. Or, you know, whatever way I counteracted him. We did a handshake. No lease. The lease would come.
Yeah.
Did a handshake. And I wasn't fazed by it at all. I was walking in there with a $500,000 business on my back, you know, bringing it into that building. Yeah. And I was really, really just replacing our roaster at the time. Yeah. It took me 3 years to get the roastery open in Bird Hill because I was distracted with running training classes and getting money in and whatever. 3 years. And I wasn't worried about it. When I got the keys for the Dock Road on the 8th of July, I told my son to come over on the 9th. We got the nail guns out and we were serving coffee by the following Friday. Mm. I didn't care what the place looked like. Yeah. Didn't care. The place looked like an empty warehouse and it was barren and there was nothing. And all there was on it was a counter that had literally been painted that morning and we were serving coffee, get the money in. Mm. I wasn't prissy about it at all. Yeah. And that was the difference because I felt the pressure, you know, it's like, we better get this started. Yeah. We cannot wait around.
It's too big. Yeah.
It's too big. It was too big. And now I look at it going, what was that?
What advice would you give to young people?
I think go and get as many experiences as you can. Mm. I look at my daughter now is currently, so she's studying in Galway, but she's in Madrid doing a year out, doing their Erasmus. And she's not really enjoying it, but it's like, well, just go there and experience it for the year. I think get as many experiences as you can and try loads of different things. Give it a year. Mm. Go try, find what you don't like and try and find the stuff that you really do like. And eventually, so you're just basically entering a funnel of life, right?
Yeah.
That's where you're going. And you're streamlining your wants, wishes and walkaways. You know, it's like, what will I walk away from? What do I want to do in my life? And go and do that.
Yeah.
Go and live on your own, make some money, lose some money, you know, struggle on, have no money, you know, make a load of money. Yeah. And
your dad will always be able to train you as a good barista.
Yeah. So listen, my kids are making coffee since they're 13, but this is like that's a really cool thing. Get a basic skill.
Yeah.
Get a basic skill and know that you can make money. Like I know I could, if this all goes pear-shaped, I know I can make money somewhere else. Yeah. I'm not worried about that at all, right? I know I'll make money. Yeah. I'm never worried about that. I remember when I was working in Dublin years ago in a restaurant called Velour, and I said to the guys, I'll turn this around for you. Give me 2 years, right? And I don't know if you remember this, but on South William Street in Dublin, Conrad Gallagher had a restaurant, Peacock Alley, all those years ago.
I remember it.
Right? And he surrendered the property and these lads came in, they turned it into Velour and it was running for 2 years and they were losing a fortune. And I got a call from a friend and it was like, would you go in there? And I said, yeah, give me two years and I'll turn this around. And I don't know why I said 2 years, but basically I was like, leave me alone and I'll fix this for you, right? And it got to the 2 years and I left. Mm. And I probably should have stayed.
Yeah.
But I left and I just bought an apartment in Donnybrook. And my dad came over to me sometime later. I met my dad for a game of golf and he was like, we need to talk. He's like, what are you doing with...
You're going through an early life crisis. <He's> like, never mind a midlife.
Yeah. He's like, you're not working. You know, you're 25 or 26. And he's like, you've got a mortgage. You have responsibilities. And you need to step up here. And I was like, sure, it'll be grand. You know, second child, middle child, you know, like middle, three boys and a girl in our family. So I was like, easy going, this'll be grand. Mm. I can make money. Mm. So it's interesting. So I think for people now, young people, just try as many things as you can, get experiences. And if you feel that you want to go in a certain direction, go that direction. Like Sarah and my daughter wanted to study in Galway. She didn't know what she wanted to do. She thought she might have an interest in psychology. Wasn't quite sure. And I was like, well, just find something that you like to do. Just go to Galway because it's calling you. You obviously want to go there. Callum, my son, wants to go to UL. He's done a year of business and Spanish, not enjoying it. He's like, it's just not for me. He wants to do something more kind of lab based, or when we built the Dock Road, actually, I gave him the nail gun and was like, go in there and panel the walls, and he loved it. You know, I feel like he might go, he's not going to be a builder, I don't know, but
something more tactile.
He just wanted, so it's like, try that. See how, don't be afraid. And I don't want them to feel that they're A, pigeonholed into, they have to do something in coffee. Like, that'd be my worst nightmare, because this was my route. Not necessarily my dream at the time, but just my, that's where I ended up, because it just kept getting filtered down. It was hotel management. It was, marketing. It was, like consumer behavior. That's interesting. Sales. I like running coffee shops. Let's add all these pieces together. And this is where I've ended up. I think that'd be what I would be saying to them, is just follow your instincts and go try shit.
You have a dinner party for six people. There's you, me, and four others. Who are they and why?
I've heard this on one of the other things.
You should have known it was coming.
I should have known it was coming.
But it's not on everyone.
It's not on everyone.
You're a foodie.
It's not on everyone.
Yeah, but it's, you're a foodie.
Well, my kids are coming. Right, with that. And Siobhan is coming, my partner. So that's four of us. And after that, I do think I'd love to dig deeper into you know, someone who has kind of done the whole thing, you know, who has come out the other end and still has their health and wealth and their mind. You know, there's some amazing characters out there, both male and female. I remember listening to, have you ever heard of Johnny Dumas? And it's one of these podcasts, and it's like How I Built This. And someone like Barbara Corcoran, you know, who, again, like, came from nothing and just built it up and has, you know, made their way into something like that. I think to get someone like that would be really interesting, and just dig deep and have that one-to-one. And then I'd leave a placeholder for my mom. She passed away a couple of years ago, so she'd love to be watching on.
That's as good as enough as any. Right. Come to that time, the black book. I'm opening it up.
Okay, ready for you.
Right. Now, this is interesting. This is interesting in light of something you said earlier on, right? How much does how you spend your time outside of work impact on how you behave or perform at work?
It is everything. It is everything. This myth that you need to work from 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. as an entrepreneur is complete bullshit. It is absolute bullshit. Work-life balance, get out of work. I train every day of the week.
Right.
I train compounds Monday, Wednesday, Friday. I do CrossFit Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday. I do hot yoga Friday nights. I'm gone at 5 o'clock every day of the week. And I need that headspace. That's what I need. I need a time to cut off, because otherwise you'll just completely immerse yourself in it, and you're just working for the sake of working, and you're fixating over micro stuff, and you're actually not dealing with the macro. Certainly at like CEO level, like, you need that disconnect. It's 100% to me, whether, you know, that's time off with my kids. Like, we spent 2 weeks down in Portugal last year surfing. I was a week over with my daughter in Madrid. I'm going again surf with my son. So at that time, and it's actually super important, just had a meeting with one of my guys, and they were like, I'm working 7 days a week. And I'm going, what are you doing? Like, that's a you problem. That's not a me. I'm not asking anybody to work. You work 5 days a week. You write your roster. Get out of work. Like, there's a work-life balance, but there's also, you have a responsibility in work. We've all a responsibility in work. So you give it your 100% there, and then you take your time off, and you take time off. It's super important, because you actually need to step away to give yourself perspective on decisions, so that you don't get overly emotional. You need to run your business with your head, and then run your family and your private life with your heart. And that's super important. And if you can disconnect efficiently and take that time out, and everybody knows that's your time out. Now, from a management level, that's how that's going to work. From an owner level, you're never off, right? I'm on 2 weeks holidays, but if something happens, I want to know about it. I don't want to come back to surprises. That's the worst thing that can happen. You need to be kept informed. And that's okay if that's an email or you jump in on a call, because you, like, as an owner, you need to be pressing the pulse every day, right? But that doesn't mean I can't emotionally disconnect from the business, right? Yeah, yeah. I can go play golf, or I can go and take a week off and spend time with Siobhan or whatever that is, and we can do that. But I think, how important is it? I couldn't put into words how important it is to get that, to get away from the work and to disconnect.
Well, that's it for this episode of Everyday Business with Aidan Donnelly. I'd just like to thank my guest, Alan Andrews. Don't forget to like, share and subscribe or comment if you enjoyed what you heard. Many thanks, and we'll see you next time.
The participants in this podcast have done so for the purpose of sharing their own individual business experiences. Some are clients of Davy and some are not. They have not received a gratuity or other payment for their time in making the podcast. The views expressed throughout are their own. Warning: the information in this podcast is not a recommendation or investment research. It does not purport to be financial advice. You should speak to your advisor in the context of your own personal circumstances prior to making any financial or investment decision. In the Republic of Ireland, J&E Davy Unlimited Company, trading as Davy and Davy Private Clients, is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Davy is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group. In the United Kingdom, Davy Private Clients UK, Davy UK and Davy Capital Markets UK are the trading names of J&E Davy UK Limited. J&E Davy UK Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. J&E Davy UK Limited is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group.